In this podcast, I discuss graphic portrayals of violence and sexual abuse. Listener discretion is advised. She's back. I'm just kidding. Well, not about being back, but about the scary music. Hello, my name is Gracie Bain, and welcome to the second season of my podcast, Ripature: Building the Myth. If you're new here, the first season of this podcast was focused on fictional adaptations of Jack the Ripper. In those episodes, we talked about how the myth of Jack the Ripper, as it has been constructed across forms and media for over a century, has created spaces for the simultaneous process of reinforcing and crossing gender and genre boundaries. Over the course of 10 episodes, we discussed how women's bodies, more specifically, the bodies of Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Kelly, were and are continuously policed by patriarchal forces while simultaneously fetishized as corpses in fiction and in the media. Jack the Ripper, a fictitious moniker for an unknown killer, has been credited as the first modern serial killer, and as such, has had a lasting impact on true crime discourse, including the ways in which gender, labor, and violence intersect, as we can see from the pervasiveness of Jack the Ripper as a cultural text. By examining the fiction surrounding the true crime story, we can examine how this myth has evolved since the Victorian period, but also how much of its gendered context remains unchanged. If any of that sounds interesting to you, take a listen to the first season. For this season, and I'm putting a question mark there, even though this is an audio medium, I've decided that we're going to do something a little different. In the next couple of episodes, we will examine other examples of Victorian true crime stories and how they've been adapted over time. We are, and have been, obsessed with Victorian violence, and it's my goal to continue the explorations we started in season one and see if they apply to other contemporaneous examples. This, even more than the first season, is going to be a lesson in adaptation, as I'm doing a lot more figuring out on the spot this time around. Some things are going to stay the same, though. Throughout the episodes, you'll hear this dinging noise whenever I'm signaling a quote from an academic scholar. I know, but you get used to it. Additionally, check out my website and show notes for sources, images, and other miscellaneous media. So, sit tight, bear with me, and get ready for this ride. Well, I've graduated, I've gotten a job, and am now officially an adult. I guess. I mean, I have back pain, so I feel like that counts, right? My entire 20s were spent in higher education and getting degrees, and I'm excited to continue this podcast in my 30s. Full transparency, though, I don't necessarily have the same tools or resources that I had in the first season. I also have a full-time teaching job, so time is very much something that I'm just trying to navigate here. I'm not trying to use this as an excuse, mostly, but one of the reasons I chose to do a podcast dissertation originally was that it allowed me to acknowledge my own positionality within my research. And I want to continue that here. So I feel like it's important for you just to know where I am. And honestly, though, I've missed this podcast. And even if no one listens anymore, besides my mom and my partner, thanks, Mom. Thanks, Ross. I still think Victorian true crime and its adaptations are important in 2025. For the first episode of this second season, again, anytime I say season, just put quotation marks in there, I want to discuss plans for the future of this podcast. The short answer is that I'm not really sure, which feels a bit unsatisfying just to me personally. I'm not exactly sure of the structure of the next episodes. In the first season, an important part of just doing a dissertation was planning and outlining the episodes well in advance, and that totally makes sense. But since I'm doing this unleashed, as it were, going much more with the flow. If I waited until I had the time and the institutional resources to produce another season in the same way I did the first one, I don't think I'd ever create anything else. Like I said earlier, this season will examine other Victorian true crime cases that inspired adaptations. It seems like, and we talked about this last season, we have this contradictory image of the Victorians, at least in media. On one hand, we have these shows that portray the Victorians as very straight-laced, prim and proper, and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, we can also easily imagine, because this is on shows too, the Victorians as dirty, poverty-stricken, living in alleyways, and that sort of thing. Historian Rosalind Crone argues that, quote, "The Victorian popular imagination was bloodier, much more explicit, and more angry and turbulent than historians have thus far been prepared to acknowledge," end quote. Popular entertainment has been violent for a very long time, well before the 21st century. I mean, people were attending public executions until they were outlawed in 1868 in England. In fact, Charles Dickens, ever heard of him, attended the execution of Maria Manning, someone that we'll actually discuss later in this season. After the execution, he laments,
"I believe that a sight so inconceivably awful as the wickedness and levity of the immense crowd collected at the execution this morning could be imagined by no man, and could be presented in no heathen land under the sun. The horrors of the gibbet and the crime which brought the wretched murderers to it faded in my mind before the atrocious bearing, looks, and language of the assembled spectators."
Psst. I don't actually think that's how Dickens sounded, but that is the best my unpaid actor, aka my partner, can do. Thank you, Ross. Coincidentally, he even wrote his own opinions about the other case that we're going to discuss first, that of Constance Kent. Cultural historians debate the reason and the meaning behind the Victorian obsession with crime and violence, because a long tradition of scholarship saw the Victorian obsession with reading about violence as reflective of their kind of primacy. Quote, "It does seem likely that the Victorian masses' sustained enthusiasm for murder was in part a product of their intellectually empty and emotionally stunted lives, so tightly confined by economic and social circumstance. In current murder, they found a ready channel both for the release of such rudimentary passions of horror, morbid sympathy, and vicarious aggression, for the sheer occupations of minds otherwise rendered blank or dull by the absence of anything more pleasing or intellectually more elevated," end quote. Richard Altick, the scholar that I just quoted, and other critics argue that the Victorian fixation on the macabre, like plays that fictionalized real-life murders or even Madame Tussaud's Hall of Horrors, resulted from tightening social, political, and intellectual restrictions and just, honestly, general boorishness. That should sound familiar to you, right? I mean, that's how we kind of think of, or that's how some people think of, our current fascination with true crime and violence. What is important in this view, though, is that enjoying violent narratives was a sign of what he called stunted lives. Again, that should sound familiar to how some people talk about true crime today. However, following in the footsteps of Foucault, most cultural historians would challenge this notion of just Victorian repression. We don't need to go into a deep dive of Foucault because, to be honest, other people have done it much better than I ever would. But Michel Foucault argued that the Victorians, rather than being prudes about sex and never ever talking about it, actually talked about sex and sexuality a lot. Like, a lot. Critics like Crone argue that Altick's claim simplifies the lives of the Victorians. Since then, the Victorians' intellectual lives have been, quote, "rescued from obscurity," end quote. All of this is to say that we know that the Victorians loved their blood, and we also know that as a culture, we've become obsessed with the concept of Victorian blood. I mean, we can see that in contemporary shows like A Thousand Blows, which supposedly follows an all-female crime syndicate led by Mary Carr. I haven't actually seen this series, but I really, really want to. Anyway, We spent some time on this in the first season when we were talking about Jack the Ripper and why we keep producing content around Jack the Ripper, but I want to return to and expand on that in our discussions in season two. So this project will combine the approach of such Victorians in seeing violent popular culture in the Victorian period as indicative of something greater than boredom, with a discussion of the negative emotions 19th century popular entertainment associated with crimes and criminals, like anger, greed, that sort of thing. Emotions mattered for Victorians because the 19th century experienced numerous and disruptive social and cultural changes. Does that also sound familiar? Victorians were being asked to reshape the world around them and figure out how they should function within the world. Criminals were often read as misinterpreting this relationship by being unable to operate well as individuals within a collective. We talked the last season about how the victims of Jack the Ripper, Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Kelly performed quote-unquote femininity inappropriately in most literature because they're most often portrayed as being sex workers. Just as a reminder, there's a recent disagreement over whether or not all of the women actually did participate in sex work, or what level of sex work or what level of participation they had, but it is undeniable that they are most often fictionalized as being sex workers. Victorians were themselves obsessed with the blood and bloodied bodies of the case, and most of the episodes explored in the first season examine how that obsession carried through to 2025. Just a side note, because this is something that has come up since the end of the last season, I had three separate people send me a video being circulated on social media discussing Russell Edwards' claim that DNA evidence from Catherine Eddowes' shawl matched the descendants of Aaron Kaminsky and thus identified him as Jack the Ripper. Just so you know, this claim was published actually a couple of years ago, but the video that was sent to me was from this year. When I responded finally to the third person who sent that video to me, I jokingly said, you know, everyone and their mother has sent this to me. You know that I actually don't consider myself a ripperologist, right? She responded, in all caps, mind you, you're the only Jack the Ripper scholar I know. So before you ask, no, I don't have opinions about the validity of that testing. I have tried to go down, or rather, I have gone down a rabbit hole about it, but I would not feel comfortable saying my opinions. I told you this last season, but it remains the same. I'm much more interested in how gender is fictionalized in the Whitechapel murders than who Jack the Ripper actually was. So to kind of put it together, a lot of what we talked about last season was why we are so obsessed with that story. And we came up with a couple of possible reasons. Some kind of deviant pleasure, maybe we get escapism in true crime because it fetishized death and bodies. Many of these have to do with how the fictionalizations affect us emotionally. So on one hand, we talked about inappropriate emotions or inappropriate femininity that the victims were often portrayed as having, i.e. they wanted to make money or perform sexual labor outside of marriage, they didn't want to become, you know, mothering figures, whatever it was. And we also talked about how what we read and watched about Jack the Ripper and the victims impacted us. I wanted to see if those reasons that we talked about last season, like pleasure, escapism, or fetishization, apply to other Victorian cases that have been fictionalized. I will be honest, a lot of 19th century cases were actually fictionalized or turned into fiction during the 19th century itself. Judith Flanders discusses this in her book called The Invention of Murder, How the Victorians Reveled in Death and Detection and Created Modern Crime, which I cannot recommend enough. These fictionalizations happen on stage, in quote-unquote memoirs reported to be by the criminal, and in museums. The two criminals or crimes I want to focus on for the next couple of episodes are two women that I was actually interested in before I ever decided to do a dissertation on Jack the Ripper. Their names are Constance Kent and Maria Manning. I am interested in the affective bonds that female murderers like Constance Kent and Maria Manning are thought of as breaking and what they can tell us about normative Victorian femininities. To put it simply, affect refers to emotions and all of the experiences, objects, and signs that influence and are influenced by them. Both Kent and Manning complicate Victorian and Neo-Victorian discussions of feeling, just as Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Kelly complicated and sometimes didn't complicate Victorian and Neo-Victorian discussion of feelings. In Willful Subjects, Sarah Ahmed argues that there are ways that people read certain bodies as affecting wrong. For Ahmed, to be what she calls an affect alien is to, quote, snap the bond, understood as snapping the affective tie of the family as well as the bond reproduction understood as fate or even fatality, end quote. The affect alien is the person who goes against the normative grain. They feel the wrong way at the wrong time. Ahmed argues that by identifying figures that feel wrong, we can examine the ways in which people are considered to feel right. Criminals are accused of feeling wrong and violating the social contract. I'm interested to see if there's any way that we can examine them in terms of those ideas about affect aliens. Ahmed writes of affect aliens, quote, "My suggestion is that we can reread the negativity of such figures in terms of the challenge they offer to the assumption that happiness follows relative proximity to the social ideal," end quote. An affect alien is often perceived as being disruptive, and Ahmed argues that we should study what individual disruption can reveal about social cohesion. Like I said, I'd like to see if there's any kind of connection between disrupting social cohesion or feeling happiness at the wrong time or feeling unhappy when you're supposed to feel happy can be applied to Constance Kent and Marie Manning. Just to be clear, Ahmed does not draw connections between affect aliens and murders. That's absolutely not something that she does in her book. And I'm really not sure that ultimately I'm going to be able to, but this podcast is essentially going to be an exploration and seeing if that's possible. So I want to examine what media portrayals of two female Victorian murderers can tell us about the relationship between the I and the we in the period, as well as the muddy boundaries between gender and feeling that we started talking about in season one. Marie Manning and Constance Kent were both thought of as feeling the wrong way and disrupting social cohesion. They were threats to the domestic ideal of the 19th century and were used as examples of what not to do. Obviously, don't commit murder, but they were also used as examples to warn people away, and by people I really mean women, away from feeling too angry, too greedy. After all, as Perry L. Curtis argues, quote, "The producers of Victorian murder news were fond of declaring that a single false step might well send a man or woman down the slippery slope of perdition to the gallows, and thence to hell," unquote. I am interested in the affective bonds that female murderers like Constance Kent and Marie Manning are thought of as breaking, and what they can tell us about Victorian femininities. Although very, very different from each other in background and crime, and we'll talk about that, Marie Manning and Constance Kent demonstrate that Victorian conceptions of femininity rely on factors like race, class, and respectability. And often those things are tied together and the boundaries between those are porous and complex. As Jenny Coleman writes, quote, "The ways in which those who break the law are described and labeled can tell us a great deal about the ways in which crime and deviance, and by mutual co-definition, normative respectability, are socially constructed," end quote. Normative respectability is rooted in the middle class, and individuals who violate this respectability are often treated differently. Ultimately, both Constance Kent and Marie Manning are described as feeling wrong, but actually it's interesting because the way that they are treated depends on who is reading the piece of media, which again, we'll talk more about later. I'm both excited, but also very nervous to start doing this again. Until I can crank out the next episode, which I have written, but I haven't recorded yet, search for information on Constance Kent and Marie Manning. Honestly, there's a lot out there. I've gone ahead and uploaded some information about them to my website so you can have some context before you start talking about the fiction. I do plan on, for the next episode, or next couple of episodes, basically doing one episode that just kind of covers Kent or Manning. I think we'll start with Kent. Talks about how they were reported in the media at the time. I mean, talk about their crime, obviously, but really focused in how they were portrayed in the media and how that kind of bled over into fiction. And then the episode after that, I'm planning on the episode or episodes, I'm not sure, to be honest, but the episode after that, planning on talking about the fiction in which their character and their crimes inspired. So again, that could very easily change. All of that is to say, bear with me as I make this podcast. And to the two people that I know for a fact will listen to this podcast, Mom and Ross, thanks for sticking with me. I'll call you later. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe. Be sure to check out my website, graciebain.com, where you can find a bibliography and links to different media and other sources. At Dr. G. Bain. I know, I made that handle when I got my PhD and I was excited to be called doctor. I'll be back later with more conversations about the fictionalization of Victorian crimes and the gender politics accompanying those.